quite a few launch sites all around, like Hatch, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Truth of Consequences, there were many different roadside launch sites.
That's right.
To include up on the southern edge of the plains of San Augustine, up on what's called the I believe they called it the Magdalena Cutoff.
Yeah.
A highway road that went from, which now is Highway 25. Interstate
right.
25, I believe, was Highway 85 at that time. And
yeah.
It was a cutoff that went right up to Magdalena.
Right.
Do you remember why would you launch from that area? In
well, we were launching west of the range in those days with a high frequency because we were flying targets for guided missiles. And the target area was the 50-mile area. And so we would position crews all along the Rio Grande area, all those various sites, from Magdalena on south to just north of Las Cruces.
So we were
launching as many as four or five a day from there.
So up in that area, you not only had recoveries up there, you also had launches.
Yeah, right.
That brings to another question. One of the so-called witnesses describes what he describes what is a recovery of a spaceship of alien origin by the Air Force.
Yeah.
But what he describes is Air Force personnel with trucks. He describes an Air Force vehicle that had a crane.
Yeah,
and then he describes a tanker truck. And he also describes an aircraft landing on a road.
Yeah.
Would any of those elements, that equipment and those procedures, would any of that have been anything you guys might have done?
Sure. All of it. The one with the crane was the BST bomb service trailer. It had a small crane on it for lifting up the payload.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the aircraft on the road. We did have aircraft. We had the L-20s were cleared to land on the road.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that would have been relatively early. Occasionally, and later on we contracted some light aircraft and they would land on the road. So yeah, and they didn't do it systematically, but if they were, if they thought they'd get close to the payload from the aircraft by just walking over, they would land on the road, yeah.
And what would there have been a tanker truck involved in any launcher recoveries?
Launch, sure. That's the helium trailers. Wait a minute. Also, occasionally we send out a fuel truck to refuel the aircraft or the helicopter in the launch area, the impact area. That's
okay.
Right. That's what that could have been. For the launch purposes, it would have been, we'd always have a helium trailer, big helium trailer. But we also, once in a while, would send out a fuel truck to refuel the aircraft. Yeah.
Okay. I backtrack a little bit. You said that sometimes you could almost track your balloons by UFO sightings.
Right, that was almost SOP. And the earlier years were even more frequent. Later on, we didn't pay as much attention, but we heard the UFO reports. In the beginning, we almost depended upon the UFO reports. Oh, it was as a supplementary setup for getting positions to supplement radar and theodolite tracking.
So,
because things were pretty crude in those days.
So, could you just explain why they would be able to see this balloon and what it might look like?
Well, even in the time of maximum visibility was sunrise and sunset, or near sunrise and sunset, when effectively they were seen for the same reason you can see satellites today after dark, but they were still in the sunlight. Even the 100,000 feet, the lag is something like 20 minutes. In other words, 20 minutes after it's dark and the sun is set on the ground, there's still sunlight at 100,000 feet. and therefore the balloon is seeing a sunset, is being lit up by a sunset which is already passed down on the ground, and the ground is starting to get into shadow. So you look up into the sky, and the balloon lights up before any of the stars are out yet. And only if there's a bright planet around, which is not too frequent, either Venus or Jupiter, will you'll have anything that even equals the light of the balloon. So you usually have one object up there in the whole sky at twilight.
And what would it look like? Would it be moving or stationary or big or?
It depends upon the time of year, and it depends how far away you are from it. Whether it looked like it was moving or not. Lots of times it just looks like another planet up there. And sometimes people would disregard it because they thought it was a planet. But other times, as it changed colors in the sunset, then it really draw attraction. That's when we got the maximum amount of reports. But we'd also get reports in the daytime because these things were getting to be pretty good size. Even early on, and you'd have a silvery object up there that would stand out in the blue, because you had the dark blue skies of New Mexico, which are exceptionally dark and blue because of the high altitude and zero pollution, particularly in the 50s, the 40s. And then you had this silvery object up against the deep blue sky, and it stand out pretty good.
Yeah, in some of the books, I'm trying to remember the exact title.
Yeah.
Some about there was a book where they wrote about some of the medical experiments where Dr. Simons actually details chasing one of his animal experiments across the country by aircraft, and one of the ways he did it was with the UFO reports when it would get
right
away from him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Particularly when we got away from New Mexico, because there wasn't as much activity outside of New Mexico. And first we flew a series in 51 in Ohio at a Wright Field auxiliary field, and that's bringing in more reports than here, but they hadn't seen any by 51. You know, they'd at least seen a fair amount here, but in Ohio it was the first time they'd been seen. It was from Moby Dick, as a matter of fact. And there was more press coverage in Ohio, more papers. So the papers were full of them. And talking about, and they described them as all different colors. You know, one observer would say, well, it was kind of red. Somebody else said it was kind of silver, pink. Some reports said it was moving fast. Others said it was still. And we had just about every description under the sun.
So is there any doubt that these people, both like in Ohio and here, when you get those reports, is there any doubt that they were your project balloons?
Oh, obviously. We knew what they were, because they had the times down right and the positions down right.
So that brings us to another question, is that due to the fact that some of these Moby Dick gopher-type flights, a lot of the Air Force might not have wanted a lot of publicity discussing these things, so they may have... It could have been described as a weather balloon or something, but...
Yeah, they had for a long, long time, they had a standard release, regardless of what the mission was, that PIO would put out. And it would say, it didn't say weather balloon, but it just said it was research balloons doing weather experiments.
Because a lot of people get hung up on thinking that these are weather balloons. These are
they
were used for weather purposes at times.
Well, they get it confused because the releases didn't say weather balloons. They said weather experiments. But they said they were studying the weather. So they figure studying the weather, they're weather balloons.
So when people envision a weather balloon, they envision something 3 or 4 feet across, made of rubber.
Yeah.
But these were the large polyethylene balloons. I believe, what was the largest one you got?
Well, it depends how late you want to get. The biggest ones were up to 40 million cubic feet.
In the picture that I saw out at the balloon branch, you could fit how many 747s in there? A dozen?
Yeah. I forget the number, but They're bigger than any other man flying vehicle. Yeah.
Bigger than I saw it in comparison to the 747, and it was many, many times larger.
Well, let's see. The Hindenburg was 7 million cubic feet. And our biggest ones were 40 million. So they're umpteen times bigger. The biggest ones are umpteen times bigger than the... And for a while, we were averaging 10 million. In the late 60s, we were averaging... The loom field as a whole was averaging about 10 million for a while. And so the average was bigger than the Hindenburg. Yeah.
The other project that you participated in during your career was the little-known Holloman branch of Project Blue Book. What was your involvement with that project?
Well, when I got back here in 51 from China Lake, it was already in process under Major Doty. And Weishand had a Blue Book office, and Holloman had a Blue Book office. I guess they were the only ones in this vicinity, the Persian ones. That were the only ones, period. The balloon branch was selected to be the Holloman office because everybody knew that most of the reports were generated by balloons anyway, so that was a good place to start. Anyway, this was not a full-time occupation. We just, my prime job was still launching balloons. We only worked on a case when there was a case. We didn't do anything interim.
So it was based that you were a meteorologist and you also worked in astronomy?
Yeah, in my case, well, there were three meteorologists, and I was one of them. But I also was an amateur astronomer. So, and it turned out entomology, I was also an amateur entomologist when I was young. Turned out entomology was also a factor, whereas we had a few insect cases that turned out to be insects. So the fact that I'd been an entomology bug when I was younger was also a help.
So you would evaluate various sightings that they had in this area? Or?
Yeah, any report was officially channeled through our office, even off hours. Yeah. I remember getting called out of the movie once. Myself and Doty were in a movie, and we got called out of the movie because it was a Harvard astronomer who was visiting who had a report, so they figured that was pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out to be Venus.
So you had a Harvard astronomer who saw Venus.
Yeah, but that was a typical case because the public are really impressed when a professional person, particularly a scientist, sees something. Not realizing that scientists have their own special field and may be real and are obviously super in their particular field but not necessarily in another field.
So,
And they don't realize that, for instance, an astronomer may be, in his case, an astrophysicist who was strictly concerned with the chemistry of stars and never looked at the sky. We're probably never an amateur astronomer even.
What about pilots?
Pilots, haven't been a pilot myself. I know that there are smart pilots and there are dumb pilots. There are some guys who are pilots just because they have, well, good pilots, but they have a great touch on the controls, but they're not too swift at understanding weather phenomena and so on. The pilots who are old and bold Boulder survivor for a long, long time. Or the pilots who do learn things about the weather and aerodynamics and so on. But you got a certain amount of pilots who are just have a great touch on the controls and not much else on the ball. So not, pilots don't universally make good observers. You
know. Anything come to mind?
What?
Any incidents come to mind as far as observing things?
Oh, lots of them. Well, for instance, even airline pilots consistently underestimate the altitude of our balloons at float.
Why is that?
Because they don't know what size an object it really is. So they presume that it's a small balloon just a few thousand feet above them, and that it was a near miss, when it's a huge balloon and it's 70,000 feet above them. And we had all kinds of cases where they called in a near miss, and once again, the balloon was at 100,000 feet.
And they were at 350 or thereabouts.
Yeah, sure. That was, they can consistently underestimate the altitude, but you have to know the size of the object for comparison. So, you know, they would get fooled by that. And of course, the motion fools them too, because your rate of onset on a target that is possibly even motionless is so rapid, you think the thing is going this way, past you like that, and actually it's sitting still. It's your own motion. They're not used to that relative motion of a relatively fixed object. They're used to the relative motions of other aircraft. See? So that fooled them also.
So a lot of people try to say that the Blue Book wasn't a real project. Any of the incidents you looked at, did you think that they had any extraterrestrial type of origin?
Oh, of course not. The whole, we solved every case we had. But we didn't have that many cases in that few years. I can't even remember because the official records are went to Wright Field afterwards, and I would say it went to the that our office only handled maybe 20 to 30 cases, and we solved all of them. Yeah, they were all either balloons or natural phenomena.
But isn't it odd that a lot of the UFO sightings happen down here in this area adjacent to the White Sands testing grounds?
Yeah, not odd. It's obvious because, anytime that somebody sees something strange and it happens to be right over the missile range, you know, it's a damn good bet that it has something to do with the missile range. Plus the visibility, of course, in Mexico was great, so you had a lot of reports. But most of the reports were close to the missile range. And I say all the cases that we handled were... I don't even think there was any case that wasn't on the missile range. No, but the missile, once again, this missile range is almost as big as the state of Connecticut. So, remember. So that, you know, entailed a lot of property.
That takes us on to another project that took place out here. It was known as Project 7218.
Oh, yeah.
Later became known as Project 7222.
Yeah.
And it began in 1953-54 time frame.
Uh-huh.
And the participation of Bloom Branch, what was the participation of Bloom Branch in that particular project? There were two reports written on it. One was known as, they were called High Altitude Balloon Dummy Drops.
Yeah.
And there was a part one and a part two.
I don't remember the differentiation. No, I remember most of the drops. I don't remember the differentiation between the part one and part two.
Part one was unstabilized, part two was stabilized.
Okay, all right, that's right. Okay, you got the framework. That's because when we started out, we didn't know what to expect. So they just flew more or less conventional parachute systems. And as a result of the tests, when they found out that with the standard parachute systems, they were not survivable with a human subject attached. That's when they started designing special parachute systems for this particular problem at Wright Field, or Wright Field did the designs. And I mean, all we were involved with is supplying the test vehicle and getting the data for them, coordinating with the range, well, the usual facilities that we offered, launch, recovery, track, coordination with the range.
So for the dummy drops,
yeah.
Reviewing the reports that they were launching one, sometimes usually two dummies,
yeah.
Up on a rack,
yeah.
Floating on a balloon to 80,000, 90,000 feet, and the dummies were dropped, and they tested various new type of parachute.
Yeah.
And they tested the rate of spin, tumbling, opening shock, things like this of the parachute. For these flights, what type of trajectory would you have wanted to use?
Well, for most of the flights, they were requiring range data, like radar and optics and telemetry. And as usual, with this type of requirement, we were required to make the drop over the 50-mile target area. And therefore, we would launch upwind, and the launch site would vary depending upon the time of year.
Mm-hmm.
the only time, well, the drop would be in the cases where we did meet the requirements or decided to meet the requirements. The drop of the dummies would be over the impact area in the middle of the range, but the instrumentation package, which we drop shortly after, might float off range. Sometimes we even put them over the mountains on the Roswell side.
Well, what I've been able to do is I went back into the records and retrieved the reports, actual reports of these dummy projects. The dummies were the Sierra and Alderson anthropomorphic dummy, possibly the Ted Smith dummy, that were launched, that were dropped from altitude. What we've got I've outlined some of the impact locations of these dummies, and it looks like most of them did fall off range. The dummies themselves actually impacted off range.
Oh, you have even with the drops that were made right on the button on target or the target area, that's where the drop occurred, but the parachute drift could carry them off range.
And the record shows that it did.
Plus, the range had priorities on missions, and we didn't have as much priority as some of the Red Hot missiles programs they had. So sometimes they come down from Wright Field, and they just had so much time down here, and therefore there were some flights where we waived the requirements for range tracking and instrumentation, and just use our onboard telemetry for it. In that case, we would launch right, we wouldn't go to a remote launch site, we just launch right from Holloman and let it go whichever way the trajectory was for that day, and it was during spring, fall, or winter, it would wind up east of the mountains.
And in some cases over west too, depending on the time.
Yeah, in the summertime it'd be west, but in spring, fall, and winter, it'd be east.
I plotted on a map where these dummies landed, and as you know in the reports,
yeah.
In these books and movies and things, is that they keep describing these bodies being around the Roswell area,
yeah.
And various people seeing them, and one gentleman even goes so far as to say, one of the witnesses says he thought it was bodies, dummies or bodies or something.
Right.
Another witness describes them as dolls.
Yeah.
So the fact that these dummy flights and the dummies themselves impacted in the Roswell area, I have just on my initial outline here, I have at least nine sets of dummies, so up to possibly 18 dummies that mm-hmm. landed within about a 40-mile radius of Roswell, New Mexico.
Sure.
Is that...
Now, some of those cases, in addition to the cases where we waived range support, you know, because of priorities and so on, we'd also had cases where you'd come over, launch remote, come over the target area, and then try to make the drop over the target area, and maybe the, or not maybe, it did happen occasionally because of antenna orientation, let's say, the signal didn't get through. And so we try it again, or we get delayed. And by this time we would be drifting, if it was most of the year, we'd be drifting east of the target area. And finally, if we got too close to the mountains where we're going to land in the mountains, then we'd delay further and wait until we clear the mountains and then make the drop using the onboard telemetry instead of the range. In other words, it'd be an aborted drop, a drop nevertheless, but we would finally have to waive the range instrumentation because we couldn't get the termination signal through on time.
So on occasion, you're saying you had difficulty, and the reports reflect that too. That you had difficulties with some of the radio signals, the electronic signals, and also sometimes balloon failure.
Yeah.
And what we have a picture of here is in the published report is a picture of the dummies being taken to altitude. In this particular instance, on a rack with instrumentation boxes and things like that.
Yeah.
We've seen indications in the records that the dummies, both or one, what they say, rode the rack all the way to the ground on a streamer.
Okay, more frequently, it might be one. In other words, the first one at work and maybe the second one got hung. But what happened with the second one was when you drop the first one, you get a big jerk on all the equipment in the balloon, which made it tangle up the rigging so that even on the second one, it's a pretty good jolt. You're dropping 200 pounds off the balloon. So you get a big jolt, and the second one was supposed to follow in seconds or whatever, the delay with it buried. The rigging would get tangled up. You know, you're going like that. And therefore, the second one was more likely to abort, and therefore have to come down on the rack, as opposed to the first one, because of that jolt that the first one would input to the system. And that was pretty hard to control.
So what these people also describe is they describe not only these alien-looking bodies, which it wouldn't take much imagination for these dummies to look like an alien body. They're bald. They have no ears. They have somewhat abstract human features, and they were in red and silver flying suits.
Yeah.
Combination red and silver for identification to pick them up on the ground. When these dummies would come down on the rack, they would come down. The reports are that the dummies in a spacecraft.
Yeah.
So if one was to imagine that this was a space alien, it wouldn't take much of a stretch.
Yeah, the rack looked like the superstructure of a craft of some kind, where the sides are blown out. I mean, all you're seeing is it looked like the rib structure of some kind of a craft.
And you, as you were controlling these, you were like the controller. You were going to do the remote firing of these electronic devices. Was there an urgency or was there a necessity to recover the dummies?
Oh yeah, of course. Because particularly when we overflew the range, then the data was all on board and we had to get the data from the onboard equipment. You wanted to analyze it for test results as fast as possible. Plus we always, for any payload, no matter what, 99% of them, we try to get to it as fast as possible.
So it would be the same procedure? You would pre-position your recovery crew?
Sure.
Many, like I said, I had nine drops that fell there around Roswell. Yeah. You would send your recovery crew over some hours before.
Sure.
And they
even
would,
in addition to before, sometimes we just try and keep up with them all the time. In other words, we didn't let the balloon get ahead of them. We try to keep pace with the balloon,
mm-hmm.
or stay ahead of the balloon. You didn't want the balloon to get ahead of them, because the balloon would take any course it wanted to, and the recovery crew had to stay with the roads. So
once again, you would target to land these dummy packages near the road.
Oh yeah, it'd be like any other operation if we were not going for range tracking.
So once again, then Highway 285, and according to these drops, could be definitely be a place where these guys would sit and wait.
Oh yeah, that'd be your first place when you clear the mountain. That was the first place you shot for.
At the time when you were recovering these dummies, do you remember any difficulties in recoveries or any?
Well, I can't remember specifically the dummies would be more difficult, because if you did drop, well, you had a number of, if you did drop at least one, that would be one impact, and you'd have, on that same flight, they have an impact of the rack, maybe with the other dummy, but didn't go, and our instrumentation. So, and we also had to recover the balloon too, because we couldn't keep them out in the field, because cattle would tend to nibble at them. And we had a few suits against the government early on with cattle, where ranchers claimed their cattle got sick and died because they ate the poly. So after they got everything else, they still had to stay in the area and either pick up or destroy the balloon.
So talking about the sequence here for the dummy drops.
Yeah.
You would drop the dummies, and then they would come down on their parachute. The rack would come down on their parachute.
Yeah.
And then would you destroy the balloon? Or?
Well, that's automatic. Yeah.
So you would destroy the balloon. And what, if, how, well, we have some of the data. We're talking about a 128-foot balloon.
Yeah.
A lot of 100, looks like 128-foot. So how many cubic feet?
800,000.
800,000 cubic feet.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you would destroy this balloon, so we had a plastic, large piece of polyethylene plastic. How would that come down?
Well, it varied. In most cases, you can have a whole bunch of small pieces and then one large piece. And the small pieces would take hours to come down because they were so light. So you get kind of a rain of this stuff fluttering down for hours after, whereas the parachute typically would take 30 minutes, so say.
1,000 feet per minute, roughly.
Well, yeah, that might be the average. You know, it starts out, drops like a rock, and then it slows down. But it's typically 30 minutes for the parachute, and pieces of balloon may be still falling over the area for hours and hours and hours, yeah.
Now, I've also seen some of the recovery pictures where very large portions of the balloon came down.
Well, yeah, most of the time you'd have one, you know, like this, you'd have one major piece.
Mm-hmm. So how would that come down? Would it?
It would kind of, it was a very mysterious looking thing. It looked like a big jellyfish type of thing just tumbling, you know, very indeterminate, crazy looking, floppy thing just come flopping down, you know, part transparent. And there was a good picture of it, of one in the book, Close Encounters. Had one that was an obvious picture of a descending balloon.
One that had been destroyed?
Yeah, they were all destroyed. That's SOP because of the FAA.
Derelict balloon regulation.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Now, once in a while, you know, maybe one out of 100 wanted to go awry and it wouldn't destroy. It would keep on floating after the destruct mechanism wouldn't work, maybe in one case out of 100. And you'd have this thing floating around for days, with no payload attached, which made it even more mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was just a big plastic cell up there flopping around, and there was nothing below it that would identify it as a balloon experiment, but there was no parachute, no payload. Just a big jellyfish flopping around for days and days. Winston had a case of one that was up for 2 weeks that way. Stirring up reports all over the damn country.
UFO reports?
Yeah, for 2 weeks.
All right. Well, that brings us to one of the project officers who worked on the project was Captain, now Colonel Joe Kittinger.
Yeah. Mm.
Just to start off with, how would you, if you physically, how would you describe him?
Well, he was a very active, red-headed, Joe wasn't small, really. He's about average size, but he's really active, you know, hyperactive, almost. And,
was his hair a little bit red, or was it bright red?
Bright red, yeah.
Because one of the reports they give in the books is they were this angry redheaded captain who's supposedly threatening people and things like this.
That's a good description of him, except he usually wasn't angry. He would just be moving around a lot and you know, yelling directions and so on.
Aggressive personality.
Yeah, aggressive personality. He was a fighter pilot. With 4 MiGs to his credit.
Well, actually one.
Just one. I never get that straight. Yeah.
Just one?
Just yeah?
One. Right.
Well, that was his problem. He wanted four.
Yeah.
four more. That was it. He had one, he wanted four. I thought it was four, and he wanted one more.
All right.
That's right, you're right.
That brings us to another thing, is that part of this dummy drop program was when Kittinger took over the project, he changed it from Project 7218, known as High Dive.
Yeah.
And, before we go into that, I'd just like to ask you a couple more questions. Do you remember a movie that was filmed?
Yes, I know, because I...
On the Threshold of Space.
I know, because I edited part of the script.
And you were in that movie.
And I was in it, too,
okay,
yeah.
As an extra.
Yeah.
Okay, our records that we reviewed show that they actually flew the gondola. Gondolas that the Air Force decided not to use didn't work out. That they actually flew that in the movie.
Yeah.
And they did fly dummies inside that gondola.
Yeah.
And the trajectory, the according to the official record, the dummies, one of them landed over near Roswell,
okay.
New Mexico. Actually, two of them did.
Okay.
Had one of them land 20 miles southeast of Roswell, and one land 45 miles southeast of Roswell.
Yeah, well, they were all launched from Holloman.
Uh-huh.
So for most of the year, they would go over the hill to the east, sure.
Okay. The funny thing about it is that these dummies are clearly shown in the movie several times.
Yeah.
As are the facilities of the balloon branch, and a lot of personnel were functioned as extras.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Well, let's run back to Joe Kittinger. So when he took over the project, it became, at some time there, it became Project 7, from 7218 to 7222.
Right.
And it was called High Dive, and Kittinger renamed it, nicknamed Excelsior.
Yeah, that's right,
Project with Excelsior. The object of this project being to test this high-altitude parachute with a live subject, which would be Captain Kittinger, and the end result was that he jumped out of the balloon gondola at 102,800 feet.
That was the final test. He had two others from balloons. Each one was a world record, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, I think, was roughly 60, and the second
90,
one...
90, I think 90. And
that was 90 was the second one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the first one was 60, the second was 90, and the third one was 102,800.
So, In this project, you were also a balloon pilot, were you not?
Yes, yeah.
And what was the purpose of you learning to fly balloon?
That was in preparation for Man High. I was initially the subject selected for Man High 1. And Kittinger and myself and Colonel Simon all simultaneously underwent training with low-level balloons to get a feel for the handling of the system. And then I washed out after an accident in one of the training flights. As far as being a pilot was concerned, yeah. But I continued on the program as meteorologist and even as astronomical advisor even.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then when Kittinger was flying, preparing for Excelsior to do the jumps,
yeah.
Do you remember other pilots coming to Holloman to take training flights with?
Yeah, I remember pilots coming, but I thought that was after Excelsior. I'm not sure, but I
think it was before.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure of that. I could pin it down to the nearest year, which is a good indicia of the people who were making his UFO report, ET reports, who were at Roswell, and if people like me who were intimately involved with the missions can't remember the exact year until we look up the dates again. What would casual passerbys, how good would their memory be as to the when exactly they saw it, since the subject wasn't brought up until 30 years later anyway.
Do you remember when these pilots came out? Do you remember what type of training profile they were on?
Yeah, it was Joe was the instructor. I didn't do any instructing at that stage of the game. I'm trying to remember why. I gave instruction to McClure. Well, anyway, that's because we had a heavy workload at the time with other programs. So Joe was the prime, was the instructor, and it was pretty casual in some ways. I mean, all you do is go up and, go verbally over the launch procedures and everything else and give them some feel of the valving and ballasting when you're in transit. And then after you got to a reasonable landing area, you would do touch and goes, just like with an aircraft. You know, with each pilot of the trainee pilots doing a landing of their own, And if it was a real difficult one, then maybe Joe would take over. But that was basically what you went through, in-flight training of the ballasting and valving, and then touch and goes, just like in an aircraft.
So do you remember a particular flight? It was towards the end of May, May 21st, 1959,
yeah,
where there was an accident.
Yeah, I even remember the launch because it was late at night, like maybe midnight, and then on takeoff, they had launched right from the back of our building, and Joe wasn't 100% sure of his ascent rate that he was going to clear the building and all the power lines, so he ballasted just as he passed over the building, and some of the ballast, I can remember it distinctly, that was some of the ballast hit some of the power lines and caused a few fireworks on the block as he passed over,
mm-hmm,
from the steel shot ballast. And then it was still dark, they went on toward the mountains and
because it was May.
Yeah, but in May you still have, May is still winter as far as the low-level winds are concerned. So they went over the Sacks and did some, and prepared for some touch and goes at sunrise. So. Then I guess we lost contact with them for a while on our side because they were, over the mountains.
Were you back at the controls?
Yeah.
For this flight?
Yeah.
Okay. It was an overnight flight.
Yeah, although we were delayed, and I think it was after midnight when they finally launched. So by the time sunrise came, it wasn't too long, I mean, 1 o'clock on sunrise might be at six, so 5 hours, 5 hours into the flight, they were setting down to do touch and goes on the eastern slopes of the mountains, yeah. And then we lost contact on our side. That's when Jorgensen and company communications vehicle that was along with recovery on the other side of the mountains. They had contact with them, and we were just getting things, information indirectly via them, and I guess the aircraft was up too, yeah.
So there was a communications vehicle?
Yeah.
And a recovery vehicle?
I know about the communications vehicle. I'm not sure about the recovery vehicle, because it was for a manned flight, it'd be they had to pick up the gondola. And there had to be a recovery vehicle.
Okay.
Because they still had to pick up the gondola.
Okay.
So, sure, after the occupants got out.
Okay.
Sure.
And also the official record shows that there was a chase helicopter.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we would always have an aircraft with them, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what, after they did some touch and goes, what did you recall happening?
Well, we didn't get the details in real time back at the control center because of the comm lag and so on. And, but we heard, we heard via the aircraft that they had some problems on landing, and then we got details later on, I talked to Joe and Kittinger after they got back and I think what we decided that happened was that we had made so many practice landings, even on prior flights, with this gondola, that the shock absorbing material on the bottom, the edges got rounded, so that when they came